Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Pope may be infallible, but he is not invulnerable. Last week, the New York Times reported that top Vatican officials, including Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the man who would become Benedict XVI, failed to defrock a priest who had abused as many as 200 boys at a Wisconsin school for the deaf. What's more, there are parallel cases coming to light across Europe. To his credit, the Pope has addressed the sex abuse issue directly, speaking to victims personally. But if he is perceived as having put the Church's reputation or his interest in other matters like doctrine before the safety of children, would this weaken the Pope's authority? And how might it affect the future of the Church? David Gibson can unpack all this for us. He has written a biography of the Pope, The Rule of Benedict. He is also a columnist for Politics Today. Welcome.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to be here.
Let's start with a broad picture. Can you give us a sense of the current scope of this scandal?
Well, I think there are two aspects of the scandal that you have to keep in mind, particularly as regards the Pope. One is this tsunami of revelations. That tsunami is the word, in fact, an Austrian cardinal used last week, a cardinal who's very close to Benedict. This tsunami of revelations that's gone really from, you know, from Ireland over the past few months, and in just recent weeks to Holland, to Austria, Switzerland, and Germany, and even in, you know, southern Germany, the very Catholic part of Germany, Bavaria, where Joseph Ratzinger was born and raised, and where he was just briefly, kind of brief hiatus in his otherwise largely academic and scholarly career. He was Archbishop of Munich from 1977 to 1982.
What is that? Go on with a pattern, what exactly happened in Germany? Because that's very close to home for him.
It is. Well, what you've had are these, it's almost a kind of, it almost replicates, I think, the pattern that we're all too familiar here with here in the United States, which is, for example, after the Boston Globe's investigation started coming out about Cardinal Law and a number of priests in Boston in 2002, that kind of uncorks the dam bursts on allegations, and victims become emboldened, prosecutors become emboldened, and of course lawyers pick up on cases, etc. So this is the same thing has happened in across Europe, and in Germany you've got hundreds of cases. It started out with a few cases coming out of in various parts of Germany of victims claiming sexual abuse by clergy, claims that have been verified. But then again, you get, you know, a dozen more, 20 more here, and soon you've got several hundred cases, including some, again, from Bavaria, which is the most Catholic part of it, many even concerning the boys' choir, where the Pope's older brother, Georg Ratzinger, was a director for 30 years. There's no evidence, no claims that Georg Ratzinger, the Pope's older brother, also a priest, was involved, but the fact that he admit to slapping the children, the boys, when they wouldn't sing properly, that kind of thing, that just added to this sort of anger and this sort of zeitgeist, if you will, of viewing the Church as complicit in this wide-scale, long-standing, over many decades abuse of children.
Yeah, in some ways, is this not a question of who wins out here in terms of reputation, the current pope or the pope before he was pope?
Well, in a sense, you're right. And in a sense, the problem for Benedict is that Pope John Paul II, his predecessor, was so enormously popular. He was the traveling pilgrim pope, the smiling pope, the man who was nearly martyred in St. Peter's Square in 1981, the guy who brought down the Iron Curtain. But you could also trace a lot of this really back to John Paul II's lack of interest in the mundane aspects of administering the Church and taking care of these things. And when these allegations came up, John Paul II was very much one to dismiss them,
he's the one who actually did he not appoint the current pope to the position then a cardinal to handle these matters, right?
He did indeed, although that he, it's very doubtful that he would have had any knowledge of these couple of cases that Benedict was involved with in Bavaria.
But Pope Benedict had to handle these cases
not until 2001. Occasionally,
right.
A case would come before the office that Benedict, then Joseph Ratzinger, headed, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. But it wasn't until these cases started coming out in great numbers and they realized that bishops could not handle them or were not handling them, that then Cardinal Ratzinger of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, the chief basically guardian of orthodoxy and doctrine for the church, said, look, send these cases to me. Thousands of these cases, came in just a very short period because it was this kind of backlog that suddenly emerged after all the media revelations. And they took the cases, there, and they started dealing with them. And actually, after 2001, 2002, and subsequent years, he dealt with them quite forthrightly. And certainly after he became Pope in 2005, he's done a much better job, frankly, than John Paul II did. But it's before that, when in the 90s and in the 80s and in the 70s when he was an archbishop, that the questions have arisen, and mainly concerning two different cases. One in the 90s is Lawrence Murphy case that you mentioned, when he was head of the CDF at the Vatican, and they did not defrock him. And the other, when he was Archbishop of Munich in 1980, and he accepted this priest into the Archdiocese of Munich, where he was to be treated by a psychiatrist for sexual abuse of children. But 5 days later, the priest was reassigned to another parish where he went on to abuse children, and they're saying Benedict, then Archbishop Ratzinger of Munich, didn't know about that subsequent assignment.
Is it plausible, by the way, that the Vatican argues that the Pope was non-responsible in these big decisions? Is it reasonable to think these cases didn't reach his desk, that people underneath him handled these
things? It certainly depends on how suspicious you are of Vatican statements, but I think that it is plausible to think that he wasn't particularly aware of these things. He's always said he's a poor administrator. He's admitted that, and I think he's shown that throughout. He just has no interest in administration. He's a theologian, a scholar, and an academic. That said, increasingly the problem is in these couple of cases, which aren't really major cases in the scope of things, but increasingly the Vatican denials of his any knowledge or involvement in these at all has been undermined by revelations that, memos were sent directly to him, or he presided at meetings
yes.
where discussions of these priests took place. So even if he wasn't directly involved or he forgot about them, look, the buck stops with the bishop. He's the one who makes the final decision on the assignment of priests and this kind of thing.
Right. I think that the stronger defense is probably, look what the Pope has done today recently, and he has, been aggressive. It's interesting that the New York's Archbishop, Timothy Dolan, in Mass at St. Patrick's yesterday, spoke to this at, which is unusual actually to speak to this kind of issue, at Palm Sunday Mass.
No one has been more vigorous in cleansing the church of the effects of this sickening sin and crime than the man we now call Pope Benedict XVI.
Does that seem right to you?
I think, Archbishop Dolan made two points that he was defending his boss, very understandably. And I think there are two, again, as you mentioned, Marty, that you can make the claim that Benedict XVI as Pope has been much more aggressive in terms of dealing with this scandal of priestly sexual abuse. On the other hand, comparing him, talking about this media conspiracy against the Pope, this anti-Catholic stuff, and comparing the Pope to almost a Christ-like figure here in this Holy Week from Palm Sunday to Easter, strikes a lot of people as a bit over the top, and the kind of counter-reaction that's going to smack of circling the wagons, and really just doesn't have, I think, is not a winning formula. What people aren't going to hold against the Pope the fact that he made what, in retrospect, are wrong decisions in these couple of cases. What they want him to do is to be forthright and honest about it, and just say, look, you know, based on what I know now, I certainly shouldn't have done that, and I should not have made those decisions. I wish I had not. But going forward, this is what we have to do. People want.
Well, they might hold it. Some people might hold it against him. But I think you're right, as they say in politics, the lack of forthrightness or the cover up, if they want to be that strong about it, is always worse than the offense. But let me ask you a question that sort of widens this whole issue out, I think, in a more important way, which is the Pope has spoken about I think what he called a new springtime of faith for Europe.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And I wonder whether this makes it winter again.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, one of his main agendas, if it's not his priority when he came in, was to try to resurrect Christianity in Christendom, that is, in Europe. He's a European man. I mean, he's through and through. He will probably be the last European pope for a long time. The church is the center of gravity of the church is shifting to Africa and Asia and Latin America. But he wants to see the church resurrected and the faith resurrected in the springtime of the church in Europe. And that's been his agenda. That's been his priority. Those are the people he should be able to speak to as a German theologian. And yet, as a result of this, his credibility is being seriously undermined. There, the numbers in Germany itself, his homeland, of people who have confidence in the Catholic Church and confidence in the Pope himself have been cut in half. They were used to be high 60s, 70s. Now it's about 35% of Germans.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Pope has written about the Church, you know, getting smaller, being less parish-based, saved by cells of believers, right? The scandal may, interestingly, ironically, perhaps, hasten that shrinkage, that change, no?
Exactly, and that, I think, is a problem, too, because what you're seeing is not that Catholics need a really good excuse to go fighting among themselves these days. You saw that in the campaign, the presidential campaign with Barack Obama a year ago with his appearance at Notre Dame, which was a huge intramural squabble over health care reform. Now with this, too, what you're seeing are papal defenders, a lot of Orthodox Catholics rallying around, that kind of small, hardcore group of loyalists rallying around, while other Catholics are either throwing up their hands in disgust or being critical of the Pope, that kind of thing. So again, it seems like it's just another chance for Catholics to divide among themselves.
You've written a book called The Rule of Benedict, but what is the subtitle of this book?
The subtitle is, because the original title is not terribly original. It originated with St. Benedict himself, who wrote the first rule. But it's the Rule of Benedict, Pope Benedict XVI, and his battle with the modern world. And
This is why I ask. You've written this biography and his battle with the modern world. I thought maybe you could give us, just as we in the minute we have left or two, a little bit of insight into his character and how he might be reacting to all of this.
Well, I think one of the best thumbnail synopses of his character was given by a curial official, official of the Roman Curia, who's a very eloquent man and very funny, who protested when when a friend of mine was saying, "Oh, Ratzinger Benedict is so conservative." He said, "No, no, no, he's not conservative. He's old-fashioned." And of course, he is conservative too. But I think you have to. He's going to be 83 in just a few weeks. On the fifth anniversary of his election as Pope, he's an old-fashioned theologian, Bavarian Catholic, who is disgusted by this sexual abuse and what he's learned of that, and so he really focuses his ire and discipline on these abusive priests. But he's also old-fashioned in his view of the Church and of Catholicism. And the idea of holding bishops accountable or even changing the structure of this beloved Church that he grew up with to make it more accountable, more transparent, is just completely alien to him. And
let me stop you there. Yes, let me stop you there because we're out of time. David Gibson, thanks so much for coming on with us and giving us this time. David Gibson has written the biography of the Pope, The Rule of Benedict. We'll be back shortly with a look at first impressions of New York. I'm Marty Goldenson in for Brian Lehrer.